So Tatiana's paper has really actually set up some of the questions I'm going to ask in very, very nice ways, and Frederic's comments around this question of what evidence-based medicine does, I think, carry on into this paper, which focuses much more on the production of knowledge in the context of two particular clinical trials. So in this presentation, I will offer a preliminary exploration of the ways in which the concept of community is constructed and enacted in sites of long-term biomedical research in South Africa. My aim is to explore how this seemingly simple concept, deployed with increasing frequency in health research and intervention, serves to stabilize a series of complex and shifting processes and to obscure powerful tensions in the ways in which individuals and collectives are engaged and understood in the context of health research. To this end, I examine how community is defined and deployed in the activities of two major research centers in South Africa. The two centers, one based in KwaZulu-Natal and the other in the Western Cape, are both currently rolling out large-scale, population-based trials of a new biomedical approach to HIV prevention, often referred to as treatment as prevention. In brief, and I'm not going to say too much about the complexities of treatment as prevention, as Tatiana has covered them and other people I'm sure are quite familiar, but we can talk more about it in conversation if you want. But in brief, the strategy is centered on intensive population-wide HIV testing campaigns, increased efforts at linkage to care, and immediate or early initiation of antiretroviral treatment. While the protocols and procedures of the trials are divergent, both engage centrally with concepts of community in their research design. To begin to trace the local social dynamics of knowledge production in such sites, the paper describes how the two programs understand and deploy concepts of community in their protocols, operating procedures, and other official documents. As I will attempt to show, the concept of community deployed in the design of so-called cluster randomized trials and in their use of related notions such as community engagement, community consent, and community acceptability hinge on quite particular conceptions of and engagements with practices of relatedness, belonging, and meaning making in each of these sites. As one of the trials is only just shifting beyond its first phase, and the other trial has not yet begun enrollment of study subjects, my remarks here are necessarily tentative. However, given the huge amounts of attention these two trials are receiving in international scientific communities and the massive investments being made, the larger of the two trials, funded by the Gates Foundation and the U.S. National Institutes of Health, has a budget of more than $100 million. It is important to raise these questions in order to frame a larger research project to follow and to shape my ongoing conversations with researchers and participants at the two sites. Tracing how these concepts are deployed is essential, I suggest, to understanding the scientific results generated by the research programs, their ethical ramifications, and the long-term effects of these kinds of trials on those living in their shadows. To this end, the paper will begin with a brief outline of the stakes of the larger project from which this presentation is drawn. I will then trace for you a kind of quick reading of how the notion of community is framed in the scientific logics of each of the trials and in their procedures of so-called community engagement and ethical practice. And then I will conclude with some very preliminary remarks and orientations for the ongoing project. More than 20 years into the HIV epidemic in South Africa, the impacts of HIV/AIDS and other diseases, and the research and interventions they have mobilized, have reconfigured many elements of social life for a large number of South Africans. In northeastern KwaZulu-Natal, where my research has been based for the last decade, nearly every family has been affected by both the long-term social consequences of the epidemic and by the ongoing research activities of major transnational research programs that have been formed to measure and address its effects. At this moment, however, much seems to be shifting as approaches to prevention and care have become increasingly biomedical, and as large populations are surveyed, tested, and enrolled in complex and costly medical regimes. For many health researchers, the shift to such intensive biomedical approaches to HIV prevention represents a transformative moment in biomedical knowledge production and public health responses to disease in Africa. As large populations are enrolled in complex and costly medical regimes in order to prevent the spread of disease. As these new approaches are rolled out, shifting networks of sociality are imagined and mobilized around the conduct of health research and the distribution of drugs and care services. The larger research project from which this paper is drawn aims to examine the complex layers of relatedness, overlapping forms of authority, and everyday intimacies created by engagements between two different sites of global health research and intervention and the communities in which they are based. In order to explore these concerns, the research asks a series of questions. How are people sorted and stratified for the purposes of research and intervention? What assumptions are made about the functioning of kinship and relatedness in such contexts? How are perceptions of community, kinship, health, well-being, risk, and vulnerability affected by the classificatory processes involved in such research? What are the dynamics of divergent forms of relatedness and reciprocity between scientists, field staff, and research participants in what are sometimes called trial communities? So in the longer paper, I give here a bit of a review of the evidence regarding treatment as prevention, but Tatiana's done a really nice job of that, so I'm gonna kind of skip over that. But as an aside, I do think there is certainly some quite important work to be done to explore the ways in which the existing body of evidence has been deployed in the production of particular kinds of consensus and international guidelines, but this isn't my project here. Despite an emergent international consensus regarding the efficacy of the approach known as treatment as prevention, researchers involved in both of the trials I trace here argue that the current evidence base does not demonstrate whether ART delivered at an earlier stage of HIV infection can prevent onward transmission of HIV at the level of populations rather than of individuals. To demonstrate this conclusively, they argue, it is necessary to conduct a randomized controlled trial of the approach in, as one of the trial protocols puts it, an appropriate population under real life circumstances. In public health and medical research, as most of us know, randomized controlled trials are widely considered the gold standard for establishing the efficacy of health interventions and have become increasingly powerful in the expanding era of evidence-based medicine and public health. In the context of treatment as prevention, however, the primary outcomes do not involve individual subjects, but rather their sexual contacts and networks, making conventional randomized control trials, which rely on individual randomization to either intervention or control arms, an ineffective way to evaluate the effectiveness of such approaches. Thus, both of the trials I describe here are designed as so-called cluster randomized trials, in which groups of subjects are randomized to receive an intervention. And this is very central to the problem I'm trying to interrogate here. While the units of randomization for such trials are diverse, including clinics, hospitals, schools, or in the case of both of these trials, entire areas, all cluster randomized trials rely on the ability to define and bound groups of individuals. In the context of the treatment as prevention trials, the unit randomized is imagined to be an entire community. However, as stated above, the way this concept is understood and deployed in the trials is quite distinct, in part due to the very different settings in which the two trials take place. So the first trial, referred to by many simply as the TASP trial, became in 2012 the first population-based trial to begin in Africa. It is being conducted by a large demographic and health research institute in northeastern KwaZulu-Natal called the Africa Center for Health and Population Studies. The center sits in the Umkhanyakude District Municipality, just above the Umfolozi River, in the region of KwaZulu-Natal, often referred to as Zululand. And this is just a map that shows you the placement of the trial. The area in gray is the demographic surveillance site, and the area that's in yellow is where the trial would take place. So it's in the same sub-district, but not in the current DSS. So the trial is designed as a two-arm cluster randomized trial with 32 clusters in total, covering a total population of 40,000 inhabitants. And I just made a quick summary of each of them because I know these are very complex trials and I'm trying to talk about both of them in a short amount of time, so I'm going to have to kind of skip over some of the complexities of their design, but we can talk more about that. So the cluster design aims, as this trial protocol describes, to minimize contamination when clusters coincide with predominant sexual networks, meaning that the effectiveness of the approach is premised on an assumption that spatially defined clusters effectively represent the sexual networks of individuals residing within the area. In defining the trial clusters, Africa Center researchers relied on the results of previous work that had defined 312 local areas. This is, I know they're kind of hard to see, but I just wanted to give you a sense of how they map onto that previous area. So it's the gray and the yellow again that we're looking at. Within the Tlabisa subdistrict, by visiting each of 26,000 homesteads in the subdistrict and asking a key respondent to name the local area in which they lived, and then digitizing these local areas around clusters of responses using a geographical information system. For the purposes of the trial, these local areas were then aggregated into 48 clusters, which were designed, according to the protocol, to encompass existing social networks and are described as having a distinct social identity, a term which is not defined in the trial protocol. While not specified in the protocol, in practice, local area maps are often overlaid onto maps of traditional authority areas, or izigodi, and the izigodi are used to define and bound collections of local areas or clusters. So this is the same map with the izigodi, the traditional authority areas being shown, which is often how these clusters are made. The second trial, generally referred to as PopArt, or by its trial number HPTN-071, is the largest population-based trial of treatment as prevention currently being conducted. The trial is being implemented by a team of partners, Stellenbosch University in South Africa, the University of Zambia, London School, and then funded by Gates Foundation and NIH. It's being implemented in cooperation with the departments of health in both countries, which is a bit different than the other trial. Unlike the TASP trial, which researchers refer to as a proof of concept trial, the PopArt trial is considered an implementation trial, meaning that it is rolled out in a way that researchers believe could be similar to the way that treatment as prevention would be implemented outside of the context of clinical research. The PopArt trial is a three-arm cluster randomized trial, which would be rolled out across 21 clusters in South Africa and Zambia, representing a total population of 1.2 million people. In the protocol, the first time the term cluster is used in describing the trial design, a parenthesis defines it as community. And for the rest of the protocol and other procedural documents, the term community is used rather than cluster to describe the groups of people randomized into trial arms. It is important to note this easy slippage between these terms and to inquire about the work these slippages and shorthands do in shoring up the production of scientific evidence in such sites. Elsewhere, the document clarifies that these clusters or communities are defined as the catchment population of a government health facility corresponding to a population of between 20,000 and 150,000 people. The protocol also points out that many of these communities were selected for inclusion in the trial because of their involvement in a previous trial conducted across the two sites. In the larger project on which this presentation is based, I attempt to elucidate the ways in which individuals residing within the study areas of the two trials understand and engage with concepts of community in their everyday experience, and to explore if or how the definitions employed by trial researchers and implemented through the study procedures shape and reshape forms of sociality as the trials proceed. The divergent understandings of community deployed in the creation of study clusters are not restricted to these scientific protocols, but are also used to define key procedures and ethical practice around the two sites in ways that may, I suggest, shape lived experience in important ways. Firstly, Both trials highlight the importance of so-called community mobilization and community engagement to the implementation of treatment as prevention. As many scholars have pointed out, biomedical approaches to HIV prevention, in fact, rely quite heavily on a series of individual behaviors. HIV testing, clinic attendance, treatment initiation, drug adherence, etc., that much research has shown are socially conditioned. Thus, the trial protocols call for community entry, community education, community trial promotion through complex strategies of community engagement. Though researchers in both trials emphasize the central importance of trust and community involvement to the success of the studies, I find it interesting to observe that engagement in both studies is described in largely instrumental terms as a necessary component of recruitment activities and of ethical procedures, rather than as central to the design and outcomes of the intervention itself. In study documents, descriptions of community engagement procedures fold into ethical concerns with ensuring what is referred to as community consent. In the context of an implementation trial like PopArt, consent is expressly not sought from each individual in the study communities. Rather, agreement is obtained from communities to take part in the study and to accept the results of the random assignment to a study arm. The PopArt protocol describes the concept thus. It is of the nature of a cluster randomized trial of this kind that entire communities are assigned to one study arm or the other, and individual consent for community allocation is not possible. However, they go on, the term community consent can be misleading. True community consent is only possible if the community has a legitimate political authority, for example, a tribal council that has the authority to make binding decisions on behalf of its members. The ethical framings and everyday operations of the Africa Center and of the TASP trial it is implementing rely quite heavily on this kind of authority. At the start of their work in the area in the early 2000s, center leadership sought the sanction of the local traditional authority, a relationship they have been careful to maintain and grow over the years through transitions in leadership of both the traditional authority itself and of the center. In 2011, to strengthen their ties with the traditional authority and to reinforce their position within the area, the center negotiated for the Zulu king, Goodwill Zwelithini, to be installed as the official patron of the center, organizing a public ceremony involving the transfer of several head of cattle to formalize the relationship. And his picture hangs right at the center of the large building, the main building of the Africa Center as you walk in. There's a big picture of him right next to a picture of Mark Walport, who was until recently the head of the Wellcome Trust. These modes of consent rely on historical forms of patronage that are highly contested in contemporary South African politics and in the experience and opinions of many individuals I have worked with in this locality. In the longer work from which this presentation is drawn, I explore the tensions produced through a reliance on such structures in contemporary health research and the ways that similar notions of patronage are deployed by research participants in their engagements with researchers. By contrast, as PopArt researchers have pointed out, identifying legitimate political authority across their 9 distinct project sites in the Western Cape is a difficult task. We will seek consent for community participation from community-level stakeholders, the protocol describes, who will be defined through the community engagement process and who will include local leaders. In part because of the challenges of defining these stakeholders and grouping them into health committees, a structure created by the National Department of Health at all clinics in the area, but which had fallen out of use in recent times, the process of engaging the community and securing community consent has taken nearly 2 years, and tensions regarding appointments on the committees and support from often divided forms of authority within the trial sites are ongoing. I find these slippages between divergent understandings of social processes to be particularly fascinating. There is a long history, as many of you know, of debate in African anthropology and in the discipline more broadly regarding the analytical concepts used to understand social and political structure and practice. As Jane Geyer described in her seminal review in 1981 of the use of concepts of household and community in African studies, debates regarding the use of these terms in place of notions of kinship and lineage, for example, represent a major tension regarding how we conceive of the place of local social structures in broader understandings of state power, capitalism, and modernization. My central concern here is to attempt to elucidate what is disguised through the use of such terms in order to understand, as Geyer puts it, the variability in ways things get done. Children brought up, livings made, authority achieved and assigned, land distributed, bride wealth paid, residence determined. In ensuring the ethical operations of the trials, researchers also deploy notions of community level risks and collective benefits. Communities may feel disempowered, the pop art protocol describes, communities may feel disempowered, the pop art protocol describes, by having a research agenda imposed on them, or they may be placed at risk of stigmatization by the publication or dissemination of research results. Large community research projects may disrupt intra-community social structures and networks that are not always easily understood by an external research team. Elsewhere, the protocol suggests that social networks could rather be enhanced through the trial. Networks of stakeholders that will be created through the implementation of the study intervention, the document states, will not only improve communication between community groups, but will also be a catalyst for reinvigorating social connections that have been threatened in the wake of poverty and HIV. To understand the contradiction between these two claims, it is important to examine the ways in which representations of kinship, family, and the social in post-apartheid South Africa have become central sites of contestation between discourses of fractured families, custom and social order, and their reconstituted forms. In much research and many popular sources, the HIV epidemic has been described as undoing that which holds the entire social fabric together. In other recent work, including that of Vin Kim, scholars have argued that the new era of treatment as prevention in fact reveals the importance of the social, variously conceived, in these so-called biomedical prevention practices, and have argued that these techniques will in fact produce new social forms, as this protocol actually suggests itself. It is clearly essential to think about the ways in which both the epidemic and the research and interventions it has mobilized have shaped and been shaped by a complex and fluid array of social forms, modes of belonging, and techniques of inclusion and exclusion. Despite being touted as an innovative form of biomedical prevention, however, I suggest that the success or failure of such trials and of new approaches to biomedical prevention of HIV will be grounded in and deeply influenced by complex histories of biomedical research and intervention, and by the longstanding inequalities and vulnerabilities that have shaped the epidemic's particularly powerful impacts in the region. These colonial residues, structured by what Shula Marx has referred to as the ambiguities of dependence, deeply shape the ways in which people give meaning to their encounters with contemporary health research and intervention campaigns in the context of the HIV epidemic in South Africa. To understand these processes, we need to think about the constitution of communities as complex, fluid, processual, rather than as static entities that can be identified and enumerated in techniques of cluster randomization. We need to examine the assumptions embedded, whatever the outcome of the contemporary biomedical prevention trials, important lessons for future HIV research and for the study of global health more generally will be drawn from a deeper understanding of the social processes and historical patterns that influence the trial's implementation, individuals' responses, and the long-term effectiveness of such interventions. We need to examine the assumptions embedded in such research, where complex social processes are simplified and abstracted in order to produce clear research protocols and significant findings.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this very exciting paper. This notion of communities, of course, have been often criticized for being a kind of reification of a notion unable to grasp with tension, inequalities, political dynamics occurring within social groups. What you show very clearly in your paper is that community, in fact, is much more than that. It's a tool allowing clinical gaze and action, and I think this is very very interesting. This is quite clear in your presentation. Nevertheless, I would like you to go further into the way this trial group define community. Is community in the context of TASP and of rural South Africa, is this community seen as it is often seen in Africa, as a caring community? Meaning, is TASP possible in this place because they are dealing with a caring community where people are connected and where lineage people are supposed to care for each other? The question is, as the notion of caring community an impact on the construction of TASP in this very place? Does the fact that the setting of the trial seems traditional as an impact on the caring community notion? So anyway, what is very interesting is you show, you go beyond the classical critique of community sense, and you show the multiple sense of community. I'm struck because it's not the first time I see a presentation about the work in this area, and in each presentation of this area, there is always a map provided, and the map always show on one side there is this observational trial, and just behind the border it's the clinical trial side. I wonder if you could not redraw those maps using displacement between families between family ties across those frontiers, or even displacement of individuals looking for care resources and knowing that if I go in that side I will get treatment, if I go that side. It seems a bit statical in each of your presentation. And same using this, in anthropology and social science, the notion of frontier has always been, frontiers are very interesting because they allow for exchanges. And so it would be very interesting to understand what kind of experience is shared between these two frontiers, how the population on each side of the frontier relate to this clinical gaze or observational gaze. Of course, I'm very fascinated by the way community is invented for the clinical trial consent. I already told you, I think really you need to rewrite the inauguration of a bridge from Gluckman using this ceremony where the clinical trial chiefs give our colonial master give to the chief a goat, or in this case it's not a goat, it's cattle, big cattle, and how it is shared between the members and how it's in fact incarnating the very existence of this trial. Mm-hmm. So really, I think you really do write it. It's really necessary, and I think this relates us to the presentation of yesterday afternoon about what is left from these experiential communities. What does it create on the long time? What knowledge and what practices is learned from these encounters, and what will remain from that? And thanks. I don't know if we start yet, but maybe why not? Yes.
Questions together at the end.
Yeah, I think yeah. Okay. Thanks very much. Anyway, thanks. It was great. Thank you. So let's listen now to Thomas Cousins for a presentation called TASP and South Africa.